Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Mother's Day is coming up on Sunday, and in this year of motherhood being even more intense than usual, we'll do three Mother's Day-related segments. We'll actually talk about women who are not becoming mothers today because new stats show more women are making that choice. We will have a call-in tomorrow to thank your mother for a specific thing. We'll reveal tomorrow what that thing is and invite you to call in and say your mom's name in conjunction with it, if you'd like. That's tomorrow. And on Monday, some of the very serious challenges around being a mother these days. Right now, we want to invite your calls if in the past year you've made a decision that you won't be having children, that you've decided to forego parenthood altogether for financial reasons or lifestyle reasons or watching your parent friends struggle this year, and that was enough to scare you off the prospect of child rearing for good. I know somebody who's deciding whether or not she ever wants to have kids because of the climate. Do I want to bring children into this world? Have you recently decided to go child-free by choice? 646-435-7280. 646-435-7280. And yes, I ask this question now because new federal data out this week reveals that the birth rate has declined for the sixth straight year in a row. So it's not just a pandemic thing. Down 4% in 2020 from the previous year, and down 19% from its recent peak in 2007, the birth rate, that is, births per 100,000 women, I think is the official stat. And that's actually a surprise to researchers who initially expected a baby bump during the pandemic with so many couples stuck at home in close quarters, right? But apparently more chose to delay their pregnancies and some to take children out of their life plans altogether. So does that sound like you? And how did you come to that decision? Have you always thought you might not have kids? Or did you always assume that one day you'd start a family and then that gradually changed for you? 646-435-7280. If you fairly recently come to the decision that you're going to be childless by choice, did the pandemic make parenting seem way too hard when those challenges come up? Did it reveal how little help mothers can expect from their government or even their spouses too often, with so much of the care burden falling on women in the past year, as has been widely discussed? Or did your, not that it doesn't always, but this, you know, we know the pandemic intensified it. Or did you lose your job and you think you might never be financially secure enough to really raise kids and be okay? Or does the world just generally seem too uncertain? I mentioned climate or politically to bring a whole new generation into it. 646-435-7280. By the way, our lines are already full. And joining us now to talk about this and help take your calls is Amy Blackstone, professor of sociology at the Margaret Chase Smith Policy Center at the University of Maine, and author of the book, Child Free by Choice, The Movement Redefining Family and Creating a New Age of Independence. Professor Blackstone, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Like I said in my intro, some sociologists expected that the pandemic would lead to a baby bump and not a baby slump, with couples stuck home so much of the time. Did you expect something similar? And does your area, or does your area of research, did it make you think differently all along about this?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I did not expect that to happen at all. Nor did any of my fellow sociologists who I spoke with who study the child-free choice. I was really surprised when I heard this prediction. And I think it overlooked, you know, many of the realities that you've already described. It also overlooked the reality that we have this amazing scientific thing called birth control. that people can use. So even if they are stuck at home and happen to be heterosexual and happen to be coupled with a person of the other sex, there are ways that they can prevent pregnancy. So no, I really did not expect to see a baby bump. And lo and behold, that has borne out to be true.
By the way, I noticed that you devote a chapter in your book to debunking what some people have called maternal instinct, a supposed power that kicks in sometime after a woman gives birth, allowing them to know when their children are sick or need something specific. You don't believe that's a thing?
Well, it's not just that I don't believe that that's a thing. It's that we don't have any scientific evidence to show that it is a thing. So, well, it is true that there is a thing called oxytocin that kicks in after a woman becomes pregnant and after she gives birth, that appears to drive the desire to nurture that new being. There isn't anything that kicks in that drives a woman to want to become pregnant. Yes, we have a sex drive, but that's different from the drive to nurture and rear a child for 18 years.
Right. So for women who've decided not to have children, which is the real topic of your book, the idea is moot. So I'm just curious, why devote time to debunking the science behind the maternal instinct in that context?
Sure. Because womanhood and motherhood are so intertwined that we almost think of them as one and the same. So I think that in order to talk about the child-free choice, we have to disentangle those two concepts. And in order to disentangle those two concepts, we have to talk about maternal instinct and what it is and what it is not.
And before we go to some calls, just the basic terminology, and I know this is not new. People have been making this distinction for decades, but child-free versus childless, right?
Right, yeah. So when I use those terms, and when most folks who research this topic use those terms, child-free is used to refer to people who have opted out of parenthood, so they've made a very intentional choice not to become parents. Childless is typically used to refer to people who are not parents, but not by choice. So they may have wanted to become parents and mm-hmm. didn't or couldn't because, you know, for any number of reasons. So while we share the status as non-parents, our experiences are very different.
Jasmine in the Catskills, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jasmine.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I am so down with this topic. It goes through my head all the time as a 41-year-old woman who has had to make different choices in my life because I'm a lesbian, I'm married, and so it wouldn't be as easy for me to just get pregnant. I have to make a very intentional choice to do so. I think in the pandemic especially, it has become very clear to me that having a child, having a biological child, is a choice I don't want to make because of the climate catastrophe and the fact that a child is really, you know, going to be another human taking up space on the planet when there are so many who are in the system and need us to choose to adopt them. But I want to make clear that this was not an easy decision for me, that a lot of people who choose to not have kids never wanted them, but I did. And this is a choice I'm making anyway, in order to hopefully remove myself a little bit from the equation.
Wow. Professor Blackstone, you want to talk to Jasmine?
Yes, thank you so much for raising that point, Jasmine. I think more and more I'm hearing that from people that they have opted out, but that it has to do with reasons for the greater good, really, and concerns around the environmental impacts of overpopulation and the high consumption rates of American babies in particular, the high carbon footprints of babies in particular who are born here. So I think what you're describing, Jasmine, is totally in line with what we're hearing more and more from people, And, you know, maybe this is the thing that will drive policymakers to think differently about how we support parents or how, you know, frankly, we don't support parents today. If we want people to opt into parenthood, we need to think differently about the supports we provide for them and about the impact of the people that we bring into the world. Maybe we think differently about immigration and adoption, to your point, Jasmine. Mm-hmm.
Jasmine. I totally agree with that. I'm really glad for that to be on the table. I feel like so often the conversation is about whether or not we should have children and we completely ignore the kids that are up for adoption. And I realize that that is a complicated system, but the world is complicated. And I think we need to be making choices that are in more alignment with the world we want to be a part of, not necessarily the world that society has dictated we should create.
Jasmine, thank you so much. Jason in Greenpoint, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jason.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My girlfriend and I have gone through this pandemic and really felt as though there's no way that we could ever possibly support a family with children. And we've seen pretty much all of our friends make the opposite decision where most of them have had their kids within the year already. And it's very ostracizing to see my network sort of growing away from us. And it feels very similar when I read in the newspaper about the American Families Plan and talking so much about family and children, and they very rarely talk about individuals. And so it's a very touchy subject for us, but we see that there's no way for us in the future, at least in the very near-term future, to be able to support ourselves, let alone children.
So that's a financial decision, it sounds like, but it also sounds like, you, among other things, but it also sounds like you've made that decision, the two of you as a couple, as something you want to stick to permanently. So like, what if you both got great jobs next week and your income went up, you know, 300%?
It depends on if we'd be happy with those jobs. I mean, we're very much interested in doing what we want to do with our lives. And that doesn't necessarily mean making hundreds of thousands of dollars. It means being busy with the things we want to be busy with. And that's not necessarily having children.
Are you getting judged?
Am I getting judged? I don't think so. Maybe for other things, but not for that. We're definitely supported by that. Our friends don't want us to go away, even though they all they talk about is babies, and we don't have much to contribute to that conversation.
Right. Jason, thank you very much. You know, Dr. Blackstone, I know somebody who is a senior citizen now, but many moons ago says she didn't want kids and felt pressured to have kids. So she and her husband had kids. And, you know, I guess it seems to have worked out fine. It seems to be happy family, grown kids now. But what surprised this person was that so many of her friends turned out not to have kids either. And she thought that the reason to have kids, or a big pressure that she experienced at the time, she says, was we're going to be the only ones. Everybody else has kids. But then consistent with these stats that are coming out, it's just becoming more and more common not to.
Yeah. I so relate to Jason's story and to that experience of watching your friend group change, because others in the group, many in the group, are opting into parenthood and you yourself are not. Really interesting to hear about the flip of that as well. But I think that one thing to keep in mind is that while we are talking as though more people are opting out of parenthood today than ever before, I think the jury honestly is still out on that question. I mean, birth rates fluctuate. We've been below the replacement rate, or mostly below it, since the 1970s. But if you look beyond the 70s, even beyond the 50s, which seems to be this magical decade that we all refer to as though birth rates were always what they were in the 50s, in 1920, 25% of women reached their 40s without ever having given birth. That figure today is 15%. Mm-hmm. So it's not that the things don't change, and we're not in this unprecedented arena in the way that I think we tend to think we are.
Lynette in Ridgewood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I was telling your screener, I've known for a long time, I did not want to be a mother, and I have a really strong belief that motherhood is a calling, or parenthood is a calling. And I think that people who really feel that work in their heart, like they, you know, most of the people that I know that have kids were always really sure that they wanted to have kids regardless of their circumstance. Financially, if they were in a relationship, that didn't matter. They just were like, where's my family? I want to have a kid. And I never had that feeling. And then as I get older, I know that I should trust that because I don't regret it. And another thing is just being a Black woman in America, I am terrified of what having a child and having to constantly worry about their safety, that just is not something I'm interested in doing.
Lynette, thank you very much. Does your research, Professor Blackstone, indicate that that is common in the African-American community?
Yes, and I confess that my research really is, in my own study, limited to my own social network, and uh-huh. I am a white woman in her late 40s, and I don't have as strong a representation of women of color or people of color in my own sample that I wish I did. There's a great researcher by the name of Kimia Dennis who studies child-free women and men of the African diaspora, and her research really is so important and needed because much of the work on this question of what drives people to make the decision to opt out of parenthood is limited in terms of the diversity of participants in the studies. So I really appreciate hearing the call and then also the point about parenthood as a calling. I mean, I would argue that that comes from our socialization and that we're told from, you know, almost the moment we're born that that is our destiny. So, of course, we grow up believing that that is true. But I agree that, you know, if you're not feeling that pull, if you don't feel the call to parenthood, it doesn't make sense to do it. It's a hard enough job as it is. So, you know, let's leave it to the folks who really feel compelled to do it and stop pushing the people who don't want to do it to opt in.
One more. Arusha in Bushwick. You're on WNYC. Hi, Arusha. We've got about a minute for you.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I think I'm going to echo a lot of what's been said here. I'm past the childbearing age. I've never wanted to have kids because of climate, because of finances. And I always doubted myself, you know, for years. And then, God forbid, being single as a woman. I mean, what are you if you don't have kids? And, you know, so it's an interesting topic. And it's like, I guess I just wanted to voice that some of us are here. We've never wanted children. We might even, God forbid, be single women on our own, but we're still worthy and we're here to help the planet and we're here to be friends and be companions and have relationships. And that's kind of all I wanted to say.
It sounds like you've had to deal with stigma. Is there a way that you've dealt with it?
You know, I started to examine. I'm like, why do I feel like I need to walk with the scarlet letter A down the street? I constantly feel like I need to say I'm sorry. And I started to examine, like, who am I apologizing for? And then I just started to accept myself, you know?
Thank you so much.
It's just nice to hear what you're talking about, especially your guest today. Thank you.
Arusha, thank you. And in our last 30 seconds, Dr. Blackstone, in addition to your own book, Child Free by Choice, The Movement Redefining Family and Creating a New Age of Independence, are there resources that you refer people to if they're on the fence, really don't know one way or another for themselves, and are trying to weigh the pros and cons?
Yes. I mean, I would say definitely check out books on parenting as well, to have a better sense of what you might be getting into. And talk with folks who have opted out to learn more about their experiences. There's a great memoir written by Marcia Drott Davis, who is a child-free woman in her 70s, called Confessions of a Child-Free Woman. And there are a couple great documentaries that have either recently come out or about to come out on the child-free choice. So more and more people are speaking out about their choice and their experience. And I think it's a great opportunity to learn from others about what their experiences are like.
Amy Blackstone, sociology professor at the Margaret Chase Smith Policy Center at the University of Maine and author of Child Free by Choice, The Movement Redefining Family and Creating a New Age of Independence. Thank you so much, Dr. Blackstone.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we talk about the remarkable and distressing census numbers that came out this week pertaining to Puerto Rico, 12% decline in the population, the biggest of any U.S. state or territory in the 2020 census as compared to 2010. And as I said at the beginning of the segment, really in a class by its own, because no state, almost no states lost population. Mostly the census is an exercise in counting how fast different states grew. West Virginia lost 3% of its population. That was the biggest state loss. Illinois lost a tiny fraction of 1% of its population. Other than that, every other state gained. Puerto Rico lost 400,000 people since 2010. That's 12% of its population. And my guest is Alana Casanova Burgess, host and producer of La Brega, Stories of the Puerto Rican Experience, the podcast. Do you want to talk about it at all, Alana, in terms of the title of the podcast? Some people listening now may have heard, but a lot would not have heard, the podcast itself or the segment when you were on talking about the title La Brega and what it actually means, this sort of muddling through when things are complicated, or define it how you want. Does it relate to that? Because leaving is not muddling through.
Ooh, what an interesting question. And I do like muddling through. I'll have to add that to my list of brega definitions. Yeah, being in La Brega is being in the struggle, being in the hustle. It means sort of negotiating a solution to a problem that you can't really resolve. So, and actually we've been hearing from a lot of listeners from different parts of the world, from Israel, from India, from Kenya, that there are other words in other languages that basically mean this, you know, when you kind of scotch tape together a solution, or as you're saying, you know, you're not doing well, you're not doing poorly, but you're just kind of holding it together, like struggling, muddling through, grappling with a problem. Yeah, I mean, in terms of what we are trying to do with the podcast and the sort of exploration of these different bregas, one thing that there's an important Puerto Rican scholar, Arcadio Díaz Quiñones, who talks about how La Brega as a word also is a word that belongs to the diaspora who, you know, came to the United States, came to New York and Chicago and elsewhere in the 50s and 60s in such huge numbers, and that they also faced this peculiar situation of being immigrants but also citizens at the same time. You know, the immigrant experience, even though Puerto Ricans are citizens, is very familiar. Not speaking the language, you know, trying to navigate a new environment. And so they were also bregando, you know, they were in La Brega. And it's a very popular word in the diaspora as well. So I'm thinking about that a bit. And also, you know, we do in the second episode talk about how that huge wave of migration was not an accident. It was something that was very much engineered by Puerto Rican officials, because they felt like there were too many people in Puerto Rico, right? I mean, so some of our listeners might have heard about different ways. There was something called La Operación, which is how many Puerto Rican women were actually sterilized in order to lower the population. But another way that they were trying to lower the number of Puerto Ricans was literally encouraging people to leave because they felt like there just were too many people. And so it's interesting. Our last caller talked about the vibe in, talked about the coming and going all the time. And we do, you know, we do have that history.
Edgardo in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Edgardo.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Alana. How are you?
Hi.
I guess I just wanted to continue to add to the conversation, because what Alana is touching on literally right now is very accurate, because what we looked at in the 1950s through 60s was Operation Bootstrap or Manos a la Obra, which is when my family came to the United States from Santurce, Puerto Rico. And what you saw in that period was about the same amount of Puerto Ricanos that have left Puerto Rico now over the census. I mean, we're looking at just under 500,000, just under a half million. And that had a significant demographic change and cultural change on the landscape throughout the United States. You know, and you just said bregando is such an important part of the diaspora's vernacular. And, you know, salsa was created, poetry, departments of studies were created across the United States because of this massive move of Puerto Ricanos. And I think what we're about to see is a cultural shift with this new generation of Puerto Ricanos that are finding home here. I'm a diasporic, and I'm a product of that generation that migrated here in the 50s. And with my time and work, you know, I've created my own philanthropic projects with my graphic novel series, La Borinqueña, because one of the most challenging things I had after Hurricane Maria was losing my family, compounded with the tax code's repeal, Tax Code 936, which was repealed in 1996, but over the 10-year phase-out, by 2006, you know, Puerto Ricanos have started leaving the island in droves, white collar, for the first time, because the pharmaceutical industry is completely collapsed. You can drive through Juncos, and it's like a ghost town now of so many of these once thriving factories are now just
there was a certain kind of tax advantage that was taken away, right?
Yeah, most certainly. And so what we've seen is, like, you've seen the tax code repeal. Then you saw Hurricane Maria recently, just four years ago. And then you've just seen the recent earthquakes. And there has been a consistent migration between between Puerto Rico and the United States. And obviously, since we're a colony of the United States with U.S. citizenship, Puerto Ricanos moving from the island to the U.S. is like, you know, someone moving from Connecticut to New Jersey. You know, all we have to do is just go to the post office and submit a change of address form. The only thing is, when we come to the United States, instantly we can vote for the commander-in-chief. Even though we can serve in the military, now we can actually vote. But it's just something that's been part of the culture. But I think that it's an important side effect, and it just came to me as I was waiting to just jump into the conversation. It's what the culture is going to change, what really is going to change. Right now, Puerto Rico is exporting incredible amounts of culture. I think one of the biggest pop stars on the planet right now is Bad Bunny, who doesn't even bother to translate his lyrics into English. But when you look at this population boom of close to 500,000 Puerto Ricanos who came in the 50s and 60s because of Operation Bootstrap, salsa was created in the 70s. You know, so what's the next boom of culture that's going to happen here in the United States? And, you know, we're watching studios and that are kind of grappling with the fact that they're witnessing that they have not been creating content that is reflective of the Latinx experience. Well, what's going to happen when there's like a boom of Puerto Ricanos into this country more so than ever before? How is that going to shift culture? And I guess that's kind of like a question I'd like to ask. Like, Alana, have you even thought about that? Like, how this may even have a significant cultural shift in U.S. culture?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I wish I were qualified to answer the question, because it's such a good one. I think one of the first things that I thought of as you were talking, Edgardo, is, you know, we had original music from Puerto Rican artists to score La Brega. And just last night, we had a little live event with this band called Balloon, which is led by the brilliant composer Angelica Negron. And they are here in Brooklyn now. They're extremely, you know, they're Puerto Rican. I was going to say they're extremely Puerto Rican, but they are. And you know, the band's members are now all over the place, but they were started in Puerto Rico some 20 years ago. And at a certain point, everybody in the band then lived in Brooklyn. you know, and they were talking a bit last night about how that move influenced their music and their sound, and thinking about, you know, a bit about the nostalgia that a lot of people feel for the island once they move, and why everybody visits so often or tries to when it's not a pandemic. And so, you know, first of all, I would encourage everybody to go seek out Balloon. It's a wonderful band, beautiful music, doing really exciting things. But, you know, I think about what Angelica was discussing last night about that cultural flow, about how her music and her thinking changed being here, and, you know, the sort of homage to the homeland. But yeah, it's a great question. You're right. You know, salsa was born here, and, you know, also the Puerto Rican flag was born in New York. A lot of people don't know that, but it was designed in New York. So, ha.
Edgardo, thanks for an amazing call. And I got to go because we're running out of time in the segment. So, Alana, last question. The idea of statehood is often brought up as a solution to many of the island's problems. That's a rising conversation in Congress right now as well, but I know different people on the island have different opinions always about statehood, independence, whatever status. Does that conversation belong in this conversation?
Just a simple last question to close out the segment.
That's right. That's in 20 seconds. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, you know, one thing that I talked about with Yarimar Bonilla the last time I was on the show with her is we were sort of talking about what it would mean now that the diaspora is so huge. You know, I think it's something like 9 million people consider themselves Puerto Rican in the United States, and it's like 3 million and change on the island. How does the diaspora, like, how do we contribute to that conversation about status? I'm sort of avoiding your question here about whether statehood would necessarily, like, fix the problem or not, because, mm-hmm. you know, that's so complicated. But mm-hmm. I think the next level question for me is, what do we do? Like, how do we contribute to that political conversation in a productive way? And should we have a say? And in what way should we have a say? And what are the mm-hmm. questions we should be asking about this process and about status?
And that's an example of the struggle, the muddling mm-hmm. through, if nothing else, right?
I got something, so.
Alana Casanova-Burgess, host of the amazing podcast series, which you should all listen to if you haven't already, from WNYC and Fortuito Studios in both English and Spanish, La Brega, Stories of the Puerto Rican Experience. Alana, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Boricua Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So Governor Cuomo has announced that businesses may reopen fully on May 19th, as we've been discussing, with social distancing or vaccine or negative test requirements or partitions in restaurants, which everybody says don't do anything. So the governor also says if you reopen economic and social activity, you also have to have transportation available. So we're going to coordinate the MTA's resumption of service with the reopening. He said that yesterday. The subways, which have been closed for a few hours overnight for cleaning and disinfection, will resume 24-hour service on Monday, May 17th. Ridership is still way down compared to before the pandemic, but also way up from the lows in ridership that were hit last year. With us now, Jose Martinez, transit reporter for the news organization The City. His latest article is appealingly titled, A push to unlock subway bathrooms as the city gets moving again. A section of the article is called No Place to Go. Jose, thanks for coming on. Welcome back. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate the invitation to join you.
And there are many tasteless jokes we could make off your headline, but we won't. But what percentage of subway stations even have bathrooms?
Just about 16%. So that's out of 472 stations throughout the system, and that amounts to really just a fraction of the available restrooms. And you combine that with the lack of restrooms at street level, in restaurants, in coffee shops, it really makes for hard times, so to speak, for anyone looking for a place to go. And in the article, we focus quite a bit on the homeless population, which, of course, is sizable in parts of the subway. and the pressure that that puts on them when they just want someplace to go.
Were the bathrooms closed because COVID spread was considered too likely inside those enclosed spaces used by one person after another?
This goes back to the early days of the pandemic when the restrooms in the subway stations were closed because of a concern among the MTA and at the time among the thinking among public health officials that you should stop the spread of COVID. There's also the issue of having staffing at that time when the pandemic was peaking in the city last spring in terms of keeping them clean. Some bathrooms in the past have been recommended to be closed by the NYPD because of concerns over vandalism or crime. So there are any number of reasons why restrooms in the subway system are closed. But when you go around and look at those few bathrooms, a lot of them still say with signs taped to the doors that the restrooms remain closed. And there are some that say because of, to stop the spread of the coronavirus.
Your story includes reports of lack of options for homeless people who used to use those bathrooms in the subway system. And the more than 500 reports so far this year of people who relieve themselves inside subway cars. Is that a higher rate of those incidents than before the pandemic?
It's not. It's actually a decrease from that same or an equal time period from earlier years. But what you have to consider, of course, is that the ridership on weekdays now is just about 40% of what it was pre-pandemic. So it's and also this was happening during a time when there has not been for almost a year now full 24/7 subway service. You know, for several months going back to last May, there was no service between 1 and 5 a.m. More recently, that window has been closed down to 2 hours a night when there is no passenger service in the subway. So you're seeing this even in spite of the cessation of subway service to the public during some of the hours during the overnight.
Yeah, but it might be a lower number of incidents, but it might be a higher rate. I'm not sure. But what options exist in the city generally for people who are street homeless?
Generally, it's places like Starbucks and McDonald's. There are very few public restrooms in the city. When you talk about going in places like the transit system, you have to go within the system but outside of the subway system. And by that, I mean places like Penn Station. Those are a draw among people who want to go to the bathroom. The bathrooms at Grand Central, the bathrooms at the Port Authority bus terminal in Midtown. You have to know your spots. There are also places within the transit system that are not maintained by the MTA, some bathrooms, say, for instance, at Fulton Center. That one, to my knowledge, has remained open, as well as the one at the Times Square station. That one has remained open, but that's maintained not by the MTA, but by some of the building property owners in Times Square. So there are just one or two or three, four places where you can go, number one or number two. Sorry about that, Brian, but I couldn't resist. But there are just those few places where you can go, but it really creates a lot of pressure for those who have limited options and who do ride the transit system because they really aren't going elsewhere.
And disturbingly, your article reports that the de Blasio administration placed 12 portable restrooms and hand-washing stations around the city during the pandemic, but two problems. 12 for all of New York City is such a tiny number. And also, all 12 were taken out of service after being vandalized? People were destroying portable public restrooms on purpose?
That is correct. They were taken out of service, and they have yet to be put back in the service. So that's an additional layer of pressure because of vandalism on public restrooms. And as you know, there are places here and there in the city. I can think of one in Greeley Square. I can think of one off of Madison Square Park, where you have some public restrooms, but it's really a small number when compared to other cities around the world and in the country. And last summer, my colleague Ruvain Blau at the city.nyc did a terrific report on the lack of options at street level for people just looking for a place to go and to speak, as I did with some of the homeless who felt they had no choice but to relieve themselves on a platform. That's really, it's gut-wrenching, and it's and they know that it's dehumanizing for them. And the gentleman I spoke to said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to have to duck behind a garbage can on a subway platform, but I was left with no choice. And that's grim.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. We are New York and New Jersey Public Radio with Jose Martinez, transit reporter for the news organization The City. And listeners, we can take a few phone calls on really the three things that we're touching on with Jose. We've only done one of them so far, subway bathrooms. You can call about that or public restroom availability in general in New York City. I know that people who've been in other world capitals, big cities around the world, say New York is so far behind many of the best. Also, the safety of the subway from COVID and from crime, which we're about to get to, and the reopening plan for May 17th, 24 hours. Your questions, comments, or stories at 646-435-7280, 646-435-7280. Just to finish up this bathrooms thread, Mayor de Blasio and Senator Schumer are calling for this reopening of 24-hour subway service on May 17th to include the reopening of subway bathrooms. Is the MTA against that?
No. The MTA has, in fact, in recent years, reopened some subway bathrooms, but I think at this point they are just going to move with recommendations on when they should go with this. But no, they want to give people more options, but at this point, I think the focus is going to be that on May 17th, for the first time in 377 nights, there will be 24/7 subway service.
All right. So I think I just said May 17th, right? Because Cuomo has announced that businesses may fully reopen on May 19th. With social distancing or vaccine or negative test requirements. So he also added this.
If you reopen economic and social activity, you also have to have transportation available. So we're going to coordinate the MTA's resumption of 24-hour service with the reopening.
Now, Jose, I don't have to tell you that many people have believed the overnight closures have been unnecessary for months, as the science has shown COVID spread comes so much more from breathing shared air than it does from touching surfaces like subway poles, though they say there can be some risk from that. But how widely held among public health experts is the belief that this overnight cleaning was really preventative, as opposed to what some people disparagingly call hygiene theater?
That term has been used quite a bit, hygiene theater, in terms of this being a maneuver to work around the issue of homelessness in the subway. So the MTA has said that intense cleaning will continue, but at the very least, we're now going to have subway service available round the clock, which we have not had since early May of 2020.
Do you know if... Have you looked at COVID infection data from people riding crowded subway cars? The ventilation is generally good, from what I understand, but 6-foot distancing is impossible in so many cases, rush hour, et cetera. I've read reports of low infection rates, but I'm curious if you know how good the studies were for rush hour conditions and things like that during different positivity rates in the city, or any way that we can say how secure or not people can feel going back.
Well, you'll recall that early in the pandemic, there was a study, I believe it was from a professor at MIT, who it was not peer-reviewed, but this study got a lot of pickup in terms of calling the subway a vector for the transmission of coronavirus. That study was widely panned. people continued to ride the subway. The MTA has insisted all along that it's safe, that people should cover their masks, cover their faces with masks. They should do their best to keep some distance, as much distance as possible, from each other, or to go wait for the next train if you're not comfortable with the one that comes in. But now we're up to the point where on weekdays, you regularly have more than 2 million people riding the subway. We're at the point where you can ride in the afternoon and say to yourself, this looks kind of familiar. That's how I was feeling yesterday mm-hmm. when I was on a train in the afternoon and thinking, well, this looks kind of the way things used to look. That's not at all what it was like last April, last May, even in the June, because ridership had disappeared. But the MTA is pushing the idea that it's as the city reopens, that the subways have to be an integral part of that. And anyone who lives in New York who relies on mass transit knows just how important the subway is to the lifeblood of this city. It's how we move. So it will be interesting to see just how many people do not come back. But there's certainly some mental hurdles to be cleared here still
mental
for some riders.
Mental hurdles, but the data on subway spread still ambiguous as far as you know, or if you haven't looked into it, you know, you can just say that.
No, I wouldn't know. I could tell you about the ones from last spring, but beyond that, I can't tell you off the top of my head where we stand there.
Juliet in East Harlem, you're on WNYC with Jose Martinez, transit reporter for The City. Hi, Juliet.
Oh, hi, thanks for having me on. Yeah, I've been in Europe and also in Japan, where the public bathrooms are clean and plentiful. But with regard to being in New York, I'm on medication, which means I have to go to the bathroom regularly. And it's a real struggle, and I take public transportation. So there's a medical issue with regard to having public bathrooms that people can use.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a medical issue, not just a convenience issue, or not just a kind of basic provision for street homeless people, right? Even for people like Juliet, who have to go frequently, as she says, because of medication that she takes. If you're on a subway trip and you know, maybe you're not even going to get off the subway in the middle of your trip just to go to the bathroom at a station that you know has one. But even before, however long you might have to walk to your home at the end of it. So there are so many reasons to have them, right, Jose?
That's right. They're really important. And I've spent enough time in the subway system for long hours that I came to know it quite well in terms of go-to spots, if you will, in the subway system, some that were fairly reliable in terms of cleanliness. But that's a big challenge, too, for the MTA, is to keep the places clean, to keep them somewhat inviting to those who need to use the restroom while in transit.
Silas in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Silas.
Yes, hello. I'd like to know, if they're going to go back to 24/7, when are they going to clean the subways? What's the time frame?
Good, straightforward question. If they're cleaning them overnight now in those closed hours and they're going back to 24/7, when do they do that cleaning that some people consider hygiene theater, but other people say it's really good to do?
It's going to continue at terminal operations. So at terminals, at end-of-line stations, you will continue to see some cleaners. In the yards when trains and subway cars are not running. But this also points to an article that I had on the city.nyc today that the Transport Workers Union says, how are they going to be able to cover all of this when they're understaffed in terms of the number of car cleaners that are employed by the MTA? It's about 8% fewer than New York City Transit employed about 2 years ago.
Why is that the case? I noticed your article from last week about a general decline in the number of subway workers from the usual 30,000 down by 2,600, which is a lot of people. So what are the implications of that?
Well, at this point, with the ridership being what it is, the impact hasn't been felt to the level that it might be if the ridership were, say, at pre-pandemic levels when we were carrying more than 5 million people a day on the subway. But when you have fewer car cleaners, when you have fewer train conductors, when you have fewer train operators, that all adds up at some point. That catches up with you, and that's what the union has been warning about. And in my story today, they warned that you're just not going to have, if the MTA does not hire and fill some of those open slots, they're not going to have the car cleaners to keep up with the grime. And that was the phrase we used, the looming grime wave in the subway system, unless, as the union says, more car cleaners are hired.
So there's the grime wave, and we'll close with one more issue, and that is the alleged crime wave and the dispute between the MTA and the NYPD over whether more cops are needed in the system. The NYPD says no, that the MTA is just fear-mongering, but the MTA says the fear has to be addressed, and here we will hear that so does the governor.
I relate to it because, as you know, I am a New Yorker, born and bred. I am smart. I am New York tough. Don't lie to me. And don't play me as a fool. Come on the subway. It's safe. Oh, really? Have you been on the subway? Because I have, and I was scared. Tell your child to run the subway, ride the subway. It's safe. Yeah, I'm not telling my child to ride the subway because I'm afraid for my child.
So we will overlook that the governor in that clip said, I am smart. Are there good data on subway crime rates during the pandemic compared to before, Jose, that you're aware of?
Absolutely. And I've done a lot of reporting in the city about crime in the subway. There were points when robbery had really spiked early in the pandemic to the point where some transit officials even pondered the idea of calling to have the National Guard brought in to supplement security in the subway system because there were so many instances of terrible things happening when it comes to robberies. I reported on the number of people ending up on the tracks, which was higher than a previous time. And all of this is done against the backdrop, as we noted earlier, of significantly decreased ridership. So, yes, there are numbers that point to significant problems within the transit system when it comes to crime. At the same time, as you noted, Brian, the NYPD, the officials with the Transit Bureau, which patrols the subway system, they have butted heads, if you will, with the leadership of New York City Transit and the MTA. And then you have the governor, remarkably, chiming in yesterday. Here is a city and a state that is pushing to reopen, that's restoring 24/7 subway service, that has municipal workers going back to the office, and the chief executive of the state, who I should note is a very, very, very inexperienced subway rider, at least in the last couple of years, saying that he doesn't feel safe in the subway. So it's really a lot of different themes and messages that you're hearing when it comes to crime. The MTA had a survey that reported that concerns over safety were of significance to a lot of riders who have not been in the system over the last year or so. So this is an issue that isn't going away, and it's certainly something that reporters like myself who cover the transit system are going to be keeping an eye on, because it's not going away anytime soon, even as the ridership returns.
We're just about out of time, but it's politically weird on both sides of it, isn't it? For the governor, who wants to promote reopening and everybody go back to normal as quickly as possible, to be saying, but the subways aren't safe. And isn't it unusual for the NYPD to be against deploying its people rather than arguing that they are needed?
There is a lot of hot political language on both sides there. And yeah, it is interesting that the governor would say something like that. And also that the NYPD, which of course is under the care of Mayor de Blasio, has said, you know, opposite what MTA leadership has said in some cases. So it's quite a jumble. It really is. But again, this isn't one that's going to go away all that easily. And even before the pandemic, you'll recall, Brian, that the MTA had pushed for the hiring of more police officers from their own police department, the MTA PD, that would go into the transit system, including some in the subways.
Jose Martinez, great transit reporter for the nonprofit news organization, The City. Jose, thanks for all this.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Brian.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.